Welcome back to the Real Talk with Dana podcast, where we talk all things nutrition, health, fitness, and mindset with a healthy side of sarcasm. I'm your host, Dana Montes of Real Food with Dana. I'm a nutritionist and body image coach, teaching women how to heal their relationship with food and their bodies, ditch the diet cycle for good, and truly thrive with real food, one delicious meal at a time. A big thanks to Just Thrive for sponsoring today's podcast. So use the code DANA10 for a 10% discount off your order at justthrivehealth.com. Guys, welcome back. We have a returning guest today on the show. Her name is Lily Nichols. She's an RDN, and she was last on episode 68, so exactly 20 episodes ago, where we discussed Lily's whole backstory, why she became interested in nutrition for pregnancy and postpartum, and real food for gestational diabetes. So be sure to check out that episode if you haven't listened yet. Again, that's episode 68, where we talked about the basics of prenatal nutrition and nutrition for pregnancy, plus very specific nutrients to focus on in pregnancy. And again, no, to reiterate, before you all ask the questions and my mom freaks out, I'm not pregnant, nor do I have any plans to become so anytime soon. So again, mom, before you freak out, chill, or any of my other family members or friends who are listening to this podcast. Hi guys. So as I mentioned on episode 68 with Lily, this realm of nutrition for pregnancy and all of the complications and nutrition stuff that go along with it are so far out of my wheelhouse. So in order to help you guys out, I wanted to go straight to the source and have Lily on again to answer your questions. So a little bit of a behind the scenes funny story about this episode. So Lily and I recorded this in the summer because she was getting pretty late into her third trimester and we didn't want to set a date to record like after she had had the baby or anything. And then when I was going back to edit the episode in July, I literally could not find the file for the episode. And this is, if this has ever happened to you, it's like losing a paper that you wrote in college or grad school. It's every podcaster's nightmare. It was completely gone. I checked every single backup, my Zoom files, my Skype files, both computers that I used to record. Nothing. And it was so disappointing. And I had to send an email to Lily being like, I'm so sorry. Like, I don't know where it went. It was just horrible. And then magically, when I was flying back from Bali for 1 million hours on the plane, I was cleaning off my desktop as one does on 14-hour flights. And I found it. I was so excited. And of course, there was no one next to me on the plane to be like actually excited about this with me. So I was just mildly freaking out by myself. It's fine. So backstory related to the podcast, I asked Lily about her second pregnancy and how it was going along because she was still pregnant when we recorded the episode. But in real-time life now, Lily actually just had her second kid, so she's postpartum and doing great. So while the intro of the episode is a little bit outdated, the information in the episode is still on point. So on this episode, what are we actually going to be talking about? How our bodies are none of your business and how your assessment of our bodies is not helpful, especially during pregnancy. And then in the meat of the episode, we're going to be talking about real food for gestational diabetes versus the conventional government's dietary guidelines and how you can take a non-restrictive nutrient-forward approach even with specific health conditions during pregnancy. We're also talking about how to get out of the mindset of gotta get my body back after the baby and the things that you can actually focus on to focus on a perspective of abundance rather than restriction in this very vulnerable time in your life. And just one last thing before we start the episode, just so you know, we are talking about some specific gram amounts of carbohydrates in this episode in the context of the government's dietary recommendations for pregnancy and how this fits in with gestational diabetes. So we are not giving prescriptions, but instead suggesting a different way to interpret those guidelines because, as we explain in the episode, they don't make any sense in the context of healing gestational diabetes with food. So just a little warning there. And now we're actually going to get to the episode.
Pregnancy is all going along as planned, which is great. What's interesting, I think everybody has different experiences, pregnancy to pregnancy, like no two are alike. I would say what I've realized, I had a couple speaking gigs where I was away from my toddler. And so what I realized is any of the perceived fatigue I had was not caused by pregnancy, just caused by being primary caretaker of a very active little toddler. So I think my pregnancies are actually more similar to each other than I thought, if you take out the variable of caring for a small child.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So there's that. I've been thankful to not have like continued nausea and food aversions after those kind of faded away, you know, early in the second trimester. So that's all good. I feel like I can eat like all the good real food, which is always such a relief when that phase is over. It usually is a phase. So, you know, hold out hope if you're still in the beginning phases. I'd say the only thing that's bugging me is my hip. I have this old rock climbing injury from years ago that flared up in my first pregnancy, then went away. And then it's flared up again this pregnancy again. So it's just one of those things where pregnancies, there's a lot of unknowns and there's a lot of, you know, curveballs thrown at you, and you can't really anticipate which one is going to come your way. So I'm thankful to not have, you know, any sort of severe pregnancy complication, but I am not as active as I would like to be because my hip hurts a lot. And, you know, I'm doing all the things, all the PT and the prenatal chiropractic, and
she's not looking for advice
scheduled. And, you know, these things like sort of help. I'm trying to be conscious about my alignment and all that stuff from my Pilates background. But, you know, it's one of those things where like your pregnancy is just a strain on your body.
Yeah.
So just owning that that's my reality right now and hoping that once again, birth will fix it and make this hip thing go away.
Yeah, isn't it funny how some things in pregnancy seem to go into remission? Like if you have an autoimmune disease or hormonal imbalances seem to like resolve themselves while you're in pregnancy, but then other things just seem to like surprise you. Here's a curveball, like, you know, here's your hip. It's going to hurt again. Sorry.
Right. I know. And I really thought that I had rehabbed that super well. So, you know, it's like you can try to do all the things and try to do all the prep, and I could be beating myself up over not doing more to have rehabbed better or not having done PT ahead of time, or, you know, but the reality is we all just do the best that we can, and then you just sort of deal with whatever pops up. And I guess the good thing is that I believe it's a temporary thing. A lot of people have weird musculoskeletal injuries flare up again in pregnancy. There's just it's a big strain on your system to carry around the extra weight, to have a lot of ligaments stretch out, to have, you know, your center of gravity change. And it's a lot on your whole, your hips and your pelvic girdle. So, you know, it's just like, I feel like I'm in the coping phase, but I know it's temporary.
Well, yeah. So speaking of that, recently you reshared a blog post that you had written during your first pregnancy that's titled "My Pregnant Body is None of Your Business." And a big part of it is that talking about how even if you had a positive body image going into pregnancy and you're enjoying your pregnant body, when people are commenting on the changes that your body is having, of you getting bigger, which is like a normal and expected and good thing. But when it happens one too many times, it starts to really get under your skin and you get really self-conscious and kind of doubt yourself. So can you talk more about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, as somebody currently pregnant in the latter stages of pregnancy, it's like, I feel like it's the same thing all over again from last time. We were out to dinner for, you know, with the family, and there's this older couple, and the guy comments as I get up from the table, like something about how are you going to manage with two? And it's like, well, I don't know. We'll figure it out when we get there. But then said, or three, looks like you're carrying twins, you know, and it's just like, it's just not a helpful comment for anyone. You know, your body changes in pregnancy for very good reason. And it's part of it is temporary. I mean, certainly like the drastic increase in size, your body will be different postpartum, and that's also okay. But like the changes happen really quickly. And like in the grand scheme of things, I mean, to gain a significant amount of weight in 9 months, really most of that weight gain is probably in 6 or 7 months of it, is just crazy. It's surprising. It's it can be uncomfortable as your skin is stretching and your joints are accommodating all these changes. And then it's hard because you're pretty much on display. At a certain point, people like know you're pregnant. They can tell based on the way you're carrying. And then I think because it's such a miraculous, almost like novel time in a person's life, a lot of people feel the need to comment on it. And most of the comments are really not helpful. I think there's only like maybe two comments you can say that are guaranteed to be non-offensive, and that's, you look great and you're glowing. Okay. Anything else about the way a person is carrying is not helpful, because you never know what the person is feeling like on the inside. So what if you're a person who carries really small and you're self-conscious about, you're worried that maybe your baby isn't growing enough. Maybe there is something clinically going on. Maybe there's a pregnancy complication going on that is causing you to have, you know, fetal growth restriction or something, where then commenting on what somebody else would think as a compliment, because our culture is so thin focused of, oh, you're so tiny. That might be really triggering to somebody. Commenting that it looks like you're carrying twins, on the other hand, is also probably going to be triggering to somebody, especially if they've had any history of body image issues. But even if they don't, it's still weird to be in this body that's changing so quickly. And it's not helpful to have every single person notice and comment on it. Sometimes it's nice to just go to the grocery store and buy your food and leave and not have anybody make any comment about your pregnancy, whether it's a kind, you look great, you're glowing, when's the baby due comment, or a borderline offensive, insensitive comment about your size or shape or how you're carrying or whatever. They're just not adding anything to the conversation. And I think it's hard for people to understand that until you've been pregnant before, because it's just so natural to comment on stuff like that. And it can come from a place of excitement, but you just want to think through all the variables of how it could be interpreted. And you just never know where the person on the receiving end is at that day, that week, for this whole phase of their pregnancy. It's just sometimes better to not say anything or just keep it so light that it can't be interpreted in the way you don't want it to be.
Yeah. And one of the comments that you made in that article that I thought was so funny is like, the person who's pregnant already knows how they're feeling. You don't need to tell them how they're feeling, you know? Like, for example, my mom, when she's like a very small person, she's like 5'1" and like on the smaller side of humans, right? And when she had my brother, he was so big, she gained like probably more than half her body weight. And she just looked like she had a massive bowling ball. And people all the time, she told me, were commenting on like, oh my, like that must be so uncomfortable. Like, how are you doing that? And she just wanted to be like, yeah, no shit, it's uncomfortable. You don't need to remind me. Like, I already feel very uncomfortable. None of my clothes fit. Even my maternity clothes from when she was pregnant with me weren't fitting. And it's just like, man, I had never thought about it that way. It's like, they already know how they're feeling. You don't need to remind them. They don't need any reminder, or even just like saying, oh my gosh, you look great. Like, when are you due? That can be a very nice and like questioning type of thing, but could also cause a lot of anxiety for the person depending on where they are in the pregnancy and where their hormones are and everything like that.
And you know, due dates are weird anyways. It's normal to give birth within a 5-week window of your due date. And so there's a bit of discomfort even on that question, because they might be trying to gauge where you are in your pregnancy to comment on whether or not you look big or small from what they think.
Commenting on
where you're at. They might, for me, I don't like people keeping tabs on when my due date is, because I know there's this large window, and then you have this added pressure when you're like getting towards the end of people being like, how are you feeling? Are you due yet? Do you have the baby yet? Like, just bombarding you with questions when you just want to be left alone. So some people aren't bothered by that comment whatsoever. It's a comment that I just give like a season. I'm due around this season or due month, and sort of leave it vague, because that gets annoying. Especially now with a growing social media presence, I'm intentionally not posting how far along I am in the pregnancy, because then you have other people who are pregnant doing like belly comparisons. You know, we all carry differently. We all gain weight at different stages. I have gained weight and carried differently this pregnancy compared to my first pregnancy, which is fairly common, but some people it's not much different one to the other. And so all of that is like this silent comparison game or like judgment going on about like what should be happening but isn't, right? And it's, again, it's not helpful.
Yeah, that's so tough. Okay, so I want to transition a little bit to talking about gestational diabetes, because this is what your first book was on, and we didn't really talk about it on the last podcast. So also, if people didn't listen to episode 68 when I first had Lily on the podcast, this is where we talked about more of the nutrition in general for pregnancy and the comparison of the conventional prenatal and pregnancy nutrition recommendations and where we might want to actually make some modifications to those, because the research is lagging. I think you said like 17 years behind last time. So let's talk about gestational diabetes. Like, what, for people who don't know, just like a little primer of like, what is it? Why does it happen? And then why do people get it who don't have blood sugar regulation issues or don't seem to have them prior to pregnancy?
All great questions. So gestational diabetes is elevated blood sugar that is either first recognized or first developed during pregnancy, which can mean two different things when you really sit down and think about it. It can mean elevated blood sugar caused purely by all the metabolic changes that are happening in pregnancy. So placental hormones make your body more insulin resistant, makes it more challenging to bring your blood sugar down. Your pancreas is tasked with pumping out like double or triple the quantity of insulin by the end of pregnancy. Maybe that adaptation isn't happening well. Maybe you've gained more weight than is expected, and that also plays a role in insulin resistance to some degree. Maybe there's some nutrient deficiencies or something going on. So we have these things that are like caused by pregnancy. And then we also have the pre-existing challenges with blood sugar regulation or insulin resistance that are worsened by pregnancy or first uncovered in pregnancy. Maybe they were undiagnosed. A lot of the time it's undiagnosed prediabetes. You know, 50% of the population has diabetes or prediabetes, and most of them are undiagnosed. So you see that just worsen during pregnancy or become apparent during pregnancy. There's a lot of different risk factors for whether or not your blood sugar is going to be elevated, and a lot of these relate back to risk factors for type 2 diabetes. So it can be a family history of diabetes. It can be starting your pregnancy at a slightly higher weight, because again, that affects your insulin resistance, or can, doesn't always. It can be a history of PCOS, because most of the time, not always, PCOS has some involvement of insulin resistance going on. There can be risk factors like maybe your mom had gestational diabetes when she was pregnant with you, and that can impact the development of your pancreas and thus your risk of gestational diabetes when you go on to become pregnant. And then if you've had previous pregnancies where the baby was born large, there's a chance that there was some blood sugar regulation issue, maybe some undiagnosed gestational diabetes perhaps going on. And so that's usually factored into the risk calculation as well.
Since this is a blood sugar regulation issue caused in pregnancy, I'm sure that since you have a whole book on this, there are certain conventional recommendations for what people should be doing if they develop or are at risk of developing gestational diabetes during pregnancy versus what you would say would be your more nutrient forward or real food recommendations based on the current research for gestational diabetes. So where are the major differences between the conventional recommendations and the ones that you use with patients?
Well, the major difference is in the carbohydrate recommendations. So if you follow the conventional guidelines, and I did this in practice for a long time because I didn't know any better, and that's what I was taught, are to eat a minimum amount of carbohydrates per day of no less than 175 grams. And I wish the listeners could see Dana's face right now.
My facial expression, my jaw just like went to the floor.
So another way to define gestational diabetes is carbohydrate intolerance of pregnancy, meaning your body cannot tolerate a large amount of carbohydrates without having high blood sugar. Now, when you think about 175 grams spread across the entire day, it's not like that's obscenely high. I mean, our dietary guidelines are suggesting like 300 grams a day plus, right? So it's not obscenely high, but for somebody with insulin resistance and for somebody who's failed a glucose tolerance test, usually the first one is 50 grams, or maybe you're in a practice which does only one glucose tolerance test of 75 grams. You split that 175 grams of carbs over the day, you're essentially saying, well, you failed a 50-gram glucose tolerance test. However, the right amount of carbohydrates for you to eat at every meal is around 50 grams of carbohydrates. And we're expecting that your blood sugar is going to be completely normal after eating that. It doesn't make sense, okay? It doesn't take an advanced degree in nutrition to come to that conclusion. But there's all sorts of warnings against going lower carb, and that's what I needed to research for myself, and that's what I summarize in a whole lot of detail and all cited in Real Food for Gestational Diabetes to give people the reassurance that it's actually okay to go less than 175 grams. Some people don't need to go that far below that, and then some people do need to go significantly below 175 grams. And as long as you're meeting your micronutrient needs, you know, getting all of your essential amino acids, all your vitamins, all your minerals, all the fatty acids, really the carbs are just like bonus food. They just taste good. You know, eat those like condiments to what your body can tolerate, but you don't have to be forcibly eating 45 to 75 grams of carbs at each meal to comply with a specific recommendation. So really that's the major difference. And then you start getting into all of the weeds of all of our policies, nutrition policies are based off of the umbrella of what the government guidelines are. So usually coming with the gestational diabetes guidelines of this minimum amount of carbs is a too low target for protein. I think we talked about protein in our first interview. A excessively low target for fat. And if you're looking at managing high blood sugar, I mean, it's usually a battle between what proportion of your diet is coming in from fat and from carbohydrates. And if you're going down on carbohydrates, you do proportionally need to eat a higher quantity of fat just to meet your calorie needs, first of all. But you tend to get actually a decent amount of micronutrients if you're eating fat in the context of real foods that naturally contain fat and not just doing like a ton of added fat. Hey, fat's delicious. I love my butter, but you know, the fat that comes in the context of an avocado or the fat that comes in the skin with the chicken that you're eating gives you micronutrients along with it. It's not just pure fat. So what this ends up causing, I guess, is quite a few people with gestational diabetes to be accidentally or sometimes even purposefully starving themselves in order to try to meet their glucose targets. So you have a lot of people that are like proportionally getting a lot of carbohydrates, but they're not getting enough fat, they're not getting enough protein, they're not getting enough calories. And that's their means of trying to control this diagnosis. That doesn't tend to work very well for a lot of reasons. But if you are, you know, 100% compliant, so say you're meeting your calorie needs, but you're also meeting their minimum quantity of carbohydrates, maybe for your calorie needs, that's 250 grams of carbs a day, and your blood sugar is elevated, their solution is to just give you insulin or blood sugar lowering medication. And nothing against insulin or blood sugar lowering medication. They are needed in many instances, but we can significantly reduce the proportion of people who will require those interventions, and also the dosage required to manage blood sugar levels. If we just don't fill their carbohydrate intolerant body with an excessive quantity of carbohydrates beyond their personal carb tolerance. I mean, again, it's not rocket science, but it is a controversial area to go into because of how this has been taught in conventional dietetics and conventional medicine.
Yeah. And when we are taught the pregnancy nutrition recommendations and anything around pregnancy, there's almost a kind of fear that you're going to do something wrong if you don't, like harmful to the mom or to the baby, if you don't give them enough carbohydrates, if you don't give them enough folic acid, which we talked about last time, not everyone tolerates very well, if you don't do all of these things. So of course, I'm sure when you were doing that research, it's like, ooh, I'm kind of, you know, going against what I've practiced in the clinic, what I've learned during school. Like, we are taught you need a lot of carbohydrates during pregnancy because you need the energy in order to build the baby and everything. But when you think about the physiology and the anatomy of the human that you're trying to build in pregnancy, protein is in every cell in your body, including your muscles, your bones, all the things. But then also your body, you as the mom, and for the baby, needs a lot of dietary fats that are coming from real food sources, because what is the brain made of, right? What is every cell membrane that we have in our body, what is it made of? Like, of course we need more dietary fat. It just honestly blows my mind when you look at the government's dietary recommendations for these kinds of things. It's like, how are you supposed to build a healthy baby if you're not getting adequate protein, if you're not getting adequate fat? And of course, like, it's almost like if you followed the recommendations to the T, there's a much higher likelihood of developing gestational diabetes because the carbohydrate recommendations are so high in comparison to the protein and the fat recommendations.
Exactly. And they have, we do have some trials. There's one that looked at a lower glycemic index diet. It's so controversial to test low carb in pregnancy, although I have consulted on a couple studies that will be getting underway soon that'll be doing more like actual low carb in pregnancy studies. So we have to wait the 5+ years for all that stuff to get out and get published. But there was a really good randomized controlled trial of a low glycemic index diet in pregnancy. So choosing higher fiber, less processed carbs over refined grains and sugars. And they found the chances that a woman would require insulin was cut in half in the group that was consuming the low glycemic index diet. You're just not getting as rapid and as high of a spike in blood sugar levels. You also see significantly less weight gain in pregnancy, meaning like people gain the appropriate amount of weight in pregnancy versus half of pregnant people gain beyond what the Institute of Medicine guidelines are. And it's like the more weight you gain, the more insulin resistance kicks in and you're already kind of fighting against an insulin resistant state in late pregnancy. It's built into our physiology to sort of make maternal tissues be like, yeah, no, thank you for these nutrients. Send them to the baby. It's built in on purpose. Your body becomes insulin resistant and you become more prone to relying on fat as fuel in late pregnancy. You see this in humans and across all mammals. Actually, a lot of our data on ketosis in pregnancy is animal data, but we have a significant amount of human data as well. And so, you know, the argument against going low carb is primarily that you might go into ketosis. And the funny thing is, your body's going to go into ketosis anyways, whether you like it or not. It's just that we're testing for ketones more often in people with gestational diabetes, where we're not in everybody else. So it's a complicated topic. And that's why like chapter 11 of Real Food for Gestational Diabetes is all about the controversy on this. But it's just silly when we don't take into consideration like what is physiologically happening and how can we better support this natural physiological process instead of trying to look at this as, well, this is something wrong. It's like, no, the elevated blood sugar is the problem. Let's like not stoke the fire here, my friends. Like you can still have real food carbs coming in, but everybody's tolerance for carbohydrates is different. And I think one of the silver linings of actually getting a diagnosis of gestational diabetes, or just even if you don't have it, having the opportunity to check your blood sugar and see where you're at, you know, in the morning before you eat and then after meals, is to figure out what your personal carbohydrate tolerance is, because it's so different person to person. But you can still, you know, people take everything to extremes. You can still have some carbs. It's just make more of those carbs come from vegetables, nuts, seeds, lower sugar fruits like berries. And then, did I say that right? Make more of your carbs come from those foods and make less of your carbs. I want to make sure I didn't say that backwards. Make less of your carbohydrates come from white flour and sugar, and then just super concentrated sources of sugar, even if they're natural, like fruit juice, dried fruit, smoothies with a lot of fruit in it, maple syrup, honey, like those are all natural and they're delicious and they're great, but they still spike your blood sugar a ton. Just like those things, have those as like treats in tiny amounts, and then, you know, get the bulk of your carbs from these other places and you're pretty much good. Like it doesn't have to be super complicated. It gets really complicated when you start forcing people to eat specific serving sizes of different things. And then you have people wondering, you'll see it in gestational diabetes forums all over the web. Like, I followed the meal plan and had oatmeal and banana and milk for breakfast, and my blood sugar spiked so high. What am I doing wrong? And it's like, oh man, like, can't we do better?
You know what, Lily? I think we can do better. So let's take a break and talk about today's sponsor, Just Thrive. So let's say, hypothetically, that you just went to a 3-day-long nutrition conference and expo where you were trying all of the fun new natural products in the industry. We're talking everything from trying yuca-based waffles to CBD-infused chocolate and coffee to gluten-free Brazilian cheese bread to kombucha and literally everything in between. Let me tell you from personal experience, because surprise, I'm talking about me again, your stomach does not feel great after food days in a row like that. So what can you do to get yourself and your digestion feeling back to normal? You take a high-quality probiotic supplement like the one from Just Thrive. They're the first spore-based probiotic and antioxidant supplement available on the retail market that arrives 100% alive to your intestines, and it doesn't even have to be refrigerated, so it's not only super easy to travel with, but it's really easy to carry the little travel-sized bottle with you at said expo that I've been talking about. So Just Thrive not only has probiotics, but they just came out with a line of both prebiotics and vitamin K2-7, which is a specific subtype of vitamin K2 that is essential to support a healthy heart, healthy circulation, your brain, your bones, and your nerves. And I actually got to meet the Just Thrive team in person this weekend, and of course, they are the loveliest humans, just as I expected. And by the way, if you're wondering what the deal with probiotics and prebiotics is, you should probably listen to last week's episode, because I talked for about 45 minutes about those. So you can get a 10% discount off your order at www.justthrivehealth.com with the code DANA10 at checkout. So just in case you're wondering, all of the formulations from Just Thrive are all natural, non-GMO, made without soy, dairy, sugar, salt, corn, tree nuts, or gluten, which basically my dad say, well, then what is in there? Well, it's just high quality probiotics and prebiotics and vitamin K27, which obviously, these free from things are important to me and many of you. As I am someone with celiac, you guys have a lot of food allergies, food intolerances, and stuff. And I also don't deal with dairy very well. So you don't want your supplement that you're taking, which you're taking to improve the health of your gut, to actually give you gut issues, duh. So that's why this is important. So get your gut health in check and grab some probiotics and prebiotics, and be sure to use the code DANA10 at justthrivehealth.com to get some free money and save 10% off your order. And now let's get back to the show with Lily.
Yeah, man, that's so tough. And it's amazing because the body is such an amazing specimen that it knows exactly what it needs to do, you know, and we just kind of need to like help it along a little bit. And those general guidelines that you were saying before would serve anyone well, right? To just include more nutrient forward foods in their diet. Not that you have to completely restrict those other ones, but when you have an underlying health condition, or if you have gestational diabetes, or if it runs in your family, that just means you need to pay a little bit more attention to these things. Like, we don't need to be forcing our bodies to try to get into ketosis when you're pregnant, right? Even if you do have gestational diabetes. Like, your body is naturally going to be doing that itself. If you do have any kind of insulin resistance, you just have to be a little bit careful about this. But this doesn't mean you have to be counting out your almonds and you can't eat raw carrots and, you know, all of the things that the keto community does to take everything to an extreme.
Absolutely. And to that point, you know, I'm micronutrient focused first. So, and I will probably be having like an in-depth webinar on this at some point, probably after my maternity leave. So this is going to be a while, but
put it on the back burner, guys. Put it on your calendar. Yeah.
Because I get asked so many questions about keto, and because so many people know me as the person who's advocating for lower carb in pregnancy, it's like, you have to remember, it's lower carb in the context of the current recommendations are 45 to 65% of your calories coming from carbohydrates. That's like a minimum of 250, 275 grams a day. And then you have, you know, the lower minimum of 175 grams per day. And so the ideal range for people is going to be quite variable. But if we're going micronutrients first, if you start restricting your intake of leafy greens and kale and almonds and avocado, say you're counting total carbs and not net carbs, like avocado has a lot of fiber, which counts towards your total carbs, even though net carbs are low, right? You start counting the carbs in your chia seeds, the 8 grams of carbs in your whole fat grass-fed Greek yogurt, and then you calculate all that out. It's really hard to get to a diet that's like, say, less than maybe 80 grams of total carbs without missing out on micronutrients. So when people are trying to aim for 20, 30 grams of net carbs, or God forbid, 20 or 30 grams total carbs in the context of pregnancy,
you're not
going to meet your micronutrient needs. I've done a number of different nutrient analyses on this, and it's like when you have to start cutting your serving, your half cup of raspberries to a quarter cup, and cutting your salad in half and eating less avocado, like, you're missing the point.
Also probably creating so much more stress on your body than is necessary, both from the deficiency that you're going to be having in carbohydrates and from the micronutrient deficiencies as a result of not having those carbohydrates, but also just the mental stress. Like, you don't need any more stress on your body in pregnancy. You have enough already.
Yeah. Yeah. So really, most of the time, I think somewhere in the 100-ish grams of carb range, plus or minus whatever you need, more active people, people who are starting their pregnancy at a low weight, anybody with a history of disordered eating or anything, like, aim on the higher end, my friends. And then if your insulin resistance is more significant, you know, you can cut back to the degree that's necessary for blood sugar control. But I think a lot of people who are really advocating for really, really low carb in pregnancy actually don't have a lot of clinical experience in pregnancy, because you really don't have to cut back super severely to get really excellent blood sugar control. So yeah.
Funny, you, like, mean people are
I'm like pro moderately low carb, not extremely low carb.
You mean people are making nutrition recommendations without any clinical experience on the internet? What? Who does that? Oh my God.
My favorite is being asked about intermittent fasting in pregnancy. And
oh my God.
A lot of times intermittent fasting and low carb kind of go hand in hand. Now, granted, we have to remember that, like, most of the people advocating for this are adult men, which by default are not going to experience pregnancy. But
tell me what to do with my body, adult men, because you know it so well. What?
I'm like, so let's just think about this for a second. You know, I usually am asking, I'm asking for context of why they're asking the question. So I'm like, I'm just curious, have you been pregnant before? Do you, have you had friends? I try to ask it in a way that's not offensive.
Have you been pregnant before?
because here's the thing, like, your body probably won't let you intermittent fast in pregnancy beyond maybe 10 to 12 hours of not eating while you sleep, which even that, sometimes you'll have phases in pregnancy where you'll wake up hungry in the middle of the night and need to eat. And that's totally okay. Eat. But this whole idea of, like, keeping your feeding window to a really short amount of time, like, try telling somebody with extreme nausea and food aversions who can only keep down 2 saltine crackers at a time that it's ideal for them to eat within an 8-hour window so they can have autophagy happening at, like, an optimal pace. Like, no, like, autophagy shouldn't even be part of your vocabulary in pregnancy. And then tell somebody who's in the third trimester who has about, you know, a quarter cup of room in their stomach because their baby is pushing up so high, that you need to fit all of your caloric and micronutrient intake into 2 meals a day. No, you're not going to be able to fit that amount of food. You're going to have extreme heartburn.
I was going to say, sounds like a recipe for heartburn.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. So, hey, if your body just happens to be a person that feels good with, you know, not having food in the middle of the night or having an earlier dinner, going right to bed, having, you know, waiting a little bit to have breakfast, like, fine. If that's working on, from a mindful eating perspective, but if you're trying to forcibly put all of your food intake into a specific window or into a set amount of meals timed exactly, like, it is such a mismatch for pregnancy, in my opinion, and also for early breastfeeding, that it's just makes me want to scream.
Yeah. So just as a point of clarification, like, that's a good general recommendation for anyone who's pregnant, or I would say really anyone at
anyone.
All, right? but when we were talking about the carbohydrates before, that was for, like, the lower carbohydrate that Lily's talking about is low compared to the very high government's dietary recommendations versus the extreme low end of things, which is keto, right? And we fall, like, right, I guess middle to upper side of that would even be considered low carbohydrate for gestational diabetes or for insulin resistance, not necessarily even for just non-insulin resistant, non-gestational diabetes having pregnant people.
Right. I'm trying to follow your logic here, but yeah. Some people do great hanging out at 175 grams of carbs a day.
Yeah.
And then some people do better with less. It's just,
right,
you want to be cautious micronutrient wise. If you're going far below about 190 grams of total carbs per day. And, you know, a lot of people, unless they're super into keto, I find underestimate their intake of carbohydrates. They're like, oh, I eat like no carbs. My diet has no carbs, but they're not like counting all the carbs. And like, I don't need people to count all the carbs, but if you're a person who's counting carbs, don't get so obsessive that you start cutting out nutrient rich foods and start cutting out vegetables, I guess.
Exactly. Kind of, yeah. The point. On the one hand, you have people that get so obsessed with their nutrition in pregnancy that they're like counting everything and they're trying to go keto or they're trying to intermittent fast or they're trying to do all of these different things to make like the quote unquote perfect baby and have the like perfect pregnancy. And you definitely can run into this with nutritionists and dietitians because we know all the things that we quote should be doing, right? And it's very hard to take a step back and say, okay, I'm just going to meet my body where it is and just do what I can and try and eat as nutrient dense as I can, right? But then on the other side of things, there are people who give themselves complete permission to eat everything I want and whatever they want in pregnancy. But then as soon as the baby is born, it's like, oh, I got to get my body back and like the post-pregnancy diet. And last time we talked about how your nutrient and energy requirements actually increase postpartum than from what they are even in pregnancy. But how can you help people avoid getting into that mindset of got to get my body back after baby?
It's so hard because our culture is just steeped in this idea that once you have the baby, things should just return to normal super quickly, including your body. And like nothing returns to normal after you have a baby. It's just a slow, steady readjustment to a new life. And it's a slow, steady healing process in your body. Even if you started your pregnancy super fit, super healthy weight, gained, you know, right within your practitioner's guidelines for pregnancy and had a, you know, a non-traumatic birth and our nursing and like all the things are just like working for you. It's still a really slow healing process internally. I think we need a more honest conversation about the nutritional depletion that happens during pregnancy, and then particularly if your nursing continues postpartum, and how we should really be focusing on repleting those nutrient stores and supporting your healing process and supporting your breast milk production if you so choose to breastfeed long term, versus all of this attention on the outward appearance of your body. It's just going to be a while for your body to heal. I mean, I remember reading a study saying that the pelvic floor takes a full year to return to baseline function. And yet, I think the message we get as moms, because we go into this 6-week postpartum checkup with our provider, which, quote, clears us for exercise or sex or other things, that you should be normal now, right? And it's like, no. This stuff takes a long time to heal. Your skin takes a long time to regain elasticity. People maintain, gain, or lose weight at different rates postpartum. Some people lose weight with breastfeeding. Some people don't. Some people even gain some weight while breastfeeding. Sometimes people will not return to their previous-ish size or weight range until they've ceased nursing, even if that's beyond 2 years after they've had their baby. And that's all okay. And that's all within normal. There's like so many factors that go into it. It's hard to say how can we like shift this conversation or make it more acceptable for people to just to not force themselves to fit into a specific body size or mold. I don't know, because it's really hard as a new mom. You've gone through this this rapid growth, rapid expansion of your body during pregnancy. And then it's like, once you have the baby, it's like, it almost feels like you're a bit of a deflated balloon. Like, I remember looking down after I had my first, it was like, whoa, my belly's gone. That's so strange. And you like stand up and look in the mirror and you're like, oh, womp, womp. Like it's different. And it does take a long time for things to heal. And some things return-ish to normal, and then normal, you know, in heavy air quotes. And then some things don't return. Your body will always be different, and that's okay. There's some really good, I think it's like Postpartum Body Project or Fourth Trimester Body Project. I'm trying to remember the exact name. There's several different photographers that have worked on normalizing the changes that your body goes through postpartum. And I think seeing more of those images is helpful for people. So you're not only seeing the like Instagram fit mom, like airbrushed photos that are making it seem as if their body is like exactly the way that it is. Even if you return to your former size relatively quickly, your body's still different. Like your muscles are still different. Your skin is still different. And it's like, you can pose at certain angles and get it just right where it's like, wow, look at me. And then you like lean over and you're like, oh man, there's like a lot of wrinkles and rolls going on there. Like this is normal. You see a naked toddler sitting down and they have rolls too. You know, it's like, why are we so concerned about looking like these stick skinny models? It's just silly.
It is really silly. Well, maybe part of the at least short-term solution here, while we're trying to, you know, just change the conversation around body image, which is an easy thing to do. What? No. But maybe it's, what are some things that moms would do better to focus on postpartum rather than restricting their calories or trying to shrink themselves? Like, what are the maybe kinds of nutrients that we can be focusing on trying to eat more of that can help us rebuild our bodies post-pregnancy and then also provide nutrients through the breast milk for the babies or through formula or whatever it is?
Yeah, so some of the nutrients that tend to be pretty depleted over the course of pregnancy are your B vitamins, especially vitamin B12. And that's one that is, particularly if you're nursing, really important to get enough of because the levels in breast milk are reflective of the amount that you consume. So especially for people who don't eat animal foods, that's one that you want to for sure supplement with because there's quite a few case studies of infants developing deficiency from not getting enough. B12 also plays a role in your red blood cell production, so your risk of anemia. So B12, iron, vitamin A, folate, they all tend to work together on supporting red blood cell production. So if you're feeling like really run down, low energy, having shortness of breath, just fatigue like crazy, probably want to get, you know, your iron status and see whether or not you're anemic and all those different blood markers tested, like a complete blood count, and then, you know, a full iron panel as well to see where you're at, because you may need additional amounts of those nutrients. Iron deficiency, especially, I mean, I just put out a post on this on my site. It affects upwards of 30% of new moms, even in the United States. And usually people are like, oh, the US, they're well nourished, they have access to food. They don't have the same risk of nutrient deficiencies as people in developing countries. Well, 47% of pregnant and breastfeeding moms are deficient in at least one micronutrient, and it's usually iron, B12, or vitamin B6. So those are things we need to take into consideration. Certainly, you know, with B12, iron, vitamin A, that's, you're going to find those all synergistically together in foods of animal origin, especially red meat, organ meats. A lot of these foods are really emphasized in traditional cultures. So maybe there's some rationale behind that wisdom. You also want to think about supporting your own connective tissue, pelvic floor, skin healing, and all that with providing enough collagen, which has glycine, proline, hydroxyproline, all of these things that help support your own collagen remodeling happening within your body. And it's pretty significant postpartum. The uterus shrinking back down from like the size of a watermelon to the size of a pear, your connective tissue remodeling, the pelvic floor, maybe you had a surgical birth, like a cesarean birth, or maybe you had an episiotomy or something, that requires collagen to heal as well. Your breasts are going to stretch a lot in the very early days postpartum when your milk is coming in. So, you know, supporting that stretching, well, hopefully, maybe avoiding stretch marks in the process, that requires collagen. And so when you look at the practices of a lot of cultures across the globe, there's a pretty heavy emphasis on soups, bone broth, stews, curries, things that are made with, you know, all the parts of the animal, nose to tail, but especially like bones, skin, parts of meat that have a lot of connective tissue in them, which is where you get your collagen. So that's a vital one. I could go on and on. There's so many nutrients that are important. I mean, vitamin D, when you're talking about supporting maternal mental health, supporting your bone health, hormone balance, your thyroid, for supplying your baby with enough vitamin D. So you might not need to give a separate vitamin D supplement. Did I say B a second ago? I meant D.
D, yeah.
So vitamin D, we have studies showing that, you know, if you provide mom with 6,400 IUs of vitamin D per day, she transfers enough through her breast milk that her breastfed baby doesn't need a separate supplement. And I think it's like upwards of 80%+ of moms would prefer to do that versus give a separate supplement to their infant. And most people don't give the supplement anyways. So we may as well just like support mom in all of these ways and then also make sure her milk has enough. A lot of these nutrients have carryover effects on your mental health as well. So vitamin D, your DHA, that's definitely one you want to replete postpartum. Let's see, vitamin B12, iron. These are all things super important for brain health and could play a role in helping you just cope with all of the mental, emotional, psychological challenges that just naturally come along with new motherhood and then can hit you at various degrees of severity. So I really think it's about sort of a holistic approach to supporting everyone, like mama and baby together. If you can support mom with more nutrient-dense foods, appropriate supplementation where needed, more rest time, more realistic discussion on the changes her body will go through in the healing process, like everybody's better for it.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. This has been great. I think that's a really good place to stop. So please tell people where they can find you and both of your books. And I assume that there isn't anything new that you're working on now aside from growing a child. But if there is, please let us know.
Yeah, I'm heading into the final stages of pregnancy. So I am I'm going to be taking a break for a little while.
Good. That's awesome.
Practicing what I write, right? So you can find Real Food for Pregnancy or Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. Both of them are on Amazon. They're linked out from my website, lilynicholsrdn.com. If you go to the book link, you'll see all the different versions of it that you can purchase and click there. I also give away the first chapter of Real Food for Pregnancy for free on that site if you just want to get more intel on like why this whole real food thing that we're talking about. I do have a free video series on gestational diabetes, which I probably didn't mention the last time we were talking, and that's over at realfoodforgd.com. So if somebody has just been diagnosed with gestational diabetes and rightfully so, you're freaking out and thinking that like your pregnancy has gone to crap and oh my gosh, I'm going to have all these complications and everything is horrible. Watch that. It'll really put it into perspective and give you some tips for just adjusting during those very early weeks. And as of what I'm working on, I just finished up 2 webinars, one on nutritional repletion postpartum and one on nutrient transfer into breast milk in the last couple months. And so those are up on the Women's Health Nutrition Academy website for people who really like to dive deep into all the nitty-gritty research. That's where I go into it all. So
cool. Well, that's awesome. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Real Talk with Dana. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your family and friends and share the love by throwing us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, which will help spread the word and do a small part to correct all of the fitness and nutrition misinformation or bullshit that's out there, which is only causing people to become more unhealthy. Come find me anywhere at Real Food with Dana on Instagram and Facebook. Join the Real Talk with Dana Facebook group for more support and discussion on these episodes. And come hang out over on realfoodwithdana.com for the show notes and totally epic and delicious recipes. And again, a big thanks to Just Thrive for sponsoring today's podcast. You guys are going to be hearing a lot about them in the future too. So make sure you go to www.justthrivehealth.com and use the code DANA10 at checkout for 10% off your purchase.